Thank you, Commissioners. Before calling Mr. Carr, just 2 points arising from issues prior to the break. One, in response to kind of like Commissioner McLeod, is shouldn't be taken from our presentation that we're suggesting that if this land's get rezoned, it will still look rural. I mean, we're talking about taking a large area of land and putting open space and recreation zoning on it. Inherent in that is a degree of change in character. I mean, to urban park maybe rather than rural, but we're not trying to maintain rural because we're saying it should be used. And secondly, on reflection of some of the questions about the size of buildings, and we possibly haven't turned our mind properly to the potential consequences of permitted activity status. Suggest to you that the more important issue is the kind of zoning, because informal recreation versus active sport and recreation, as we read the rules, informal recreation isn't much more than wandering around open space. Permitted. Even a little BMX trail or something would require discretionary activity considered informal recreation. So informal recreation is very passive, very not much of anything. Active sport and recreation, on the other hand, encompasses a wide range of things. And the focus of our thrust is this land should always own active sport and recreation. I'm very happy, they also have no difficulty with possibly a bespoke control on buildings. Not trying to get unlimited 400 square metre buildings as a right. That wasn't the intention. The intention was to go for the active sport and recreation zoning. So we will give thought to that and in our reply. Possibly think about maybe another rule or another column or whatever that makes it quite clear that we're quite happy for buildings, or most buildings, and facilities to be subject to the landscape classification assessment matters that are in the zone. That way, whether it ends up in OL or RLC, the white ones will apply. So yeah, we will amend the proposal along those lines so that the council has whatever degree of control it considers necessary over buildings and accumulation of multiple buildings, which we think is very unlikely, but we accept it could happen. So we'll address that afterwards. On that basis, I'll call Mr. Carr, who's finally managed to make it through the howling blizzards of whatever we've been hearing here in Dunedin. And once again, his evidence has been circulated to commissioners, be taken as read, and he's here to answer any questions.
Clarify the situation with respect to your client's land. There's two access points. One's Woodgin, the other is Lake Hayes, Hayes Creek Road. Now, in terms of this particular land, one imagines that access would be along Hayes Creek Road, or the development of that.
The Brysdale land is towards the east. Central and western parts of land the council wants.
Yep.
Western part has got the place. Shall I repeat that?
No, I just did it.
Okay.
Yes, are there any, I read you in this last, are there any significant obstacles to development that access?
To Hayes Creek Road, or to which place it's going?
To Hayes Creek Road, or upgrade as public road.
As I understand it, the public road extends to what is essentially the northern boundary of the sign that's shown in purple,
yeah.
And beyond that it's then onto either reserve or rural, but the legal road, as I understand it, doesn't extend much beyond what is presently sealed.
Oh, yeah, that's already clear, obviously, so it doesn't extend right down to the river, sort of paper road or something like that.
No, not to my knowledge. No.
Thank you.
Could you tell to you how big is the other two areas together, the council land and the Brysdale sites put together? Not necessarily all the little bits of council land, but the ones that might be developed for
so the whole area is 34.8812 hectares.
The purple area. 32 hectares.
34, nearly 35 hectares.
Yeah. Yes, in my mind it was about 40, but that is not quite there. Okay. So you've assessed the capacity of the two roads that lead there, the Widgeon Place and the other one, Hayes Creek Road.
Yes.
And said, well, you know, quite a lot of hectares, depending on how they're developed and whether the activities overlap or not, could be accommodated between those two roads and the roads that lead from them out to the main roads.
Yeah.
Because you've started with the roads and look at what could be developed.
Yes.
But what we're looking at is starting with the zoning and looking what could be developed. How do we accommodate the level of, how do we control the development on those areas to achieve your limits? Or are you assuming there's going to be some form of consenting which would say, well, no, you can't have 25 sports fields, you can only have 15 or...
Well, I've fallen back onto what I understand to be the general zone provisions, which relate to essentially a complex of playing fields, if I can put it very crudely, whether that's cricket, it's equestrian or whatever, but a sort of development which is biased towards having larger playing areas with buildings that are ancillary to that, as opposed to large buildings which cover the whole area where they have lots of indoor courts. So that's the purpose of sort of using the three exemplar pitches that I've used within my analysis. This is similar to a very loose plan change is how I had it in my head, in the sense of it's not a certain amount of development which is permitted, but a number of playing fields, different types of playing fields would all be permitted. And there'll be nothing to stop duplication of playing fields, you know, the cricket oval in summer, and then it becomes a regular pitch around in winter or something like that. So it does become really difficult to be very prescriptive about the trafficking. The second issue that arises from that is when it comes to recreational use, the use of those areas can be very different as well. So when I worked on the aquatic centre way back when, the capacity of Joe O'Connell Drive wasn't an issue, but then what happened is the schools and some of the soccer clubs, rugby clubs, all decided that they were going to have their training facilities, training sessions on a weekday peak in the evening, and suddenly there were lots of parking problems that weren't there initially. The council then had to retrofit car parking. So recreational facilities do also change over time. So what I tried to do within my analysis was try to take a reasonable assessment of what could fit on that site, and then work out what the size of the site was for what could then take place, bearing in mind that some of that activity would not be in the peak hours. So that's the sort of tried approach that I tried to take. It's not a sort of a development where you can do it the traditional way of calculating the traffic generation and seeing what works on the road, even if it was not within this particular context, but a private plan change or something like that.
Because I suppose my concern is that with the active sport and recreation zone, sports fields are permitted, they're not permitted in the informal recreation zone.
Yeah.
So, and this, I mean, it's odd, and then it would be private land on which maybe sports fields could be developed alongside sports fields on the council land if it was up zone to active sport too. And when we drove down the roads that go to these areas, I mean, they are residential streets essentially, and they weave around a bit before they from the main road, if you call it that. Excuse me, I'm going to start coughing. So how can we be sure that the level of sports fields that could be developed on there can be accommodated from those zones?
That's in terms of
And it's not parking, but traffic.
Yeah. I think you can have confidence that this is a low traffic generator per se, because of the nature of the activity. It requires a lot of land for not many people. And you can have confidence that this is also an area of land that will not be generating its traffic to any large extent during the peak hours. So there's two elements of built-in mitigation, if you like, for the proposal. So what then, within my table two, what I did within there was calculate that between about 14 to 36 hectares on the site could be developed. And that was assuming that that extent of development occurred and coincided with the peak hours on the network. The difficulty we have as traffic engineers is that we collect data for the peak hours, but outside of the peak hours there's not a lot of information available. But if we can accommodate up to between 14 and 35 hectares in the peak hours, assuming that the site was fully developed and assuming that it was even at the higher end of the range, there would still be mitigation of not all of that traffic being generated and not all of the site potentially being developed. That would lie on top of that. Probably a very convoluted way of saying I think that the numbers that are in there are pretty conservative, but I can't do anything else other than just assess what could occur at the peak hours. If you were to say, well, outside of the peak hours the traffic volume on the road would be half, those numbers would increase much higher site itself.
Just following on from that, Mr. Carr, if you look at those sport fields, soccer rugby, cricket, being used on Saturday mornings for school children games,
yeah.
I'm not sure the figures to account with a they tend to get twice as many fields. Games as they do for adults. None of them can drive, so invariably there's 22 cars from a soccer game, maybe 20 from some car shares, but it's not very often because the parents often want to go. I just wonder if you looked at the amount of traffic generation going. Yes, it's not a peak, but the effect of that traffic going through the residential streets, for instance, in Lake Hayes Estate, you generally have to sort of wind either through the Drysdale subdivision or go down Judge and Drury Drive to get down to that area, don't you? And both routes are reasonably narrow residential roads, they're not arterial or anything like that. Was the residential amenity affected by that volume of traffic?
Oh, I'm dreading you using the word amenity. The amenity in traffic grounds is very difficult to define from a traffic engineer because everything falls into a different discipline. So it's noise, it's the acoustician, it's air quality, and something else. So. And the feeling of the traffic on the road is something that probably the psychologists are best left to sort out. And in terms of the question that you pose, if you were to have this being used significantly by schools all at the same time, on a Saturday morning, the first difficulty that I have as a traffic engineer is there's no data on a Saturday morning. But second thing is whether, in fact, all these schools will coincide and whether they will be staggered. If you have 20 matches that all start at the same time, then you have general participants turning up roughly within a fairly small area. If you're staggering them, then one starts every 20 minutes, you have a third of the traffic, but obviously it's taking place over a longer period of time. So there are various permutations as to what can happen within the site, which I agree are not covered off in my evidence. So that then falls back on what is the appropriate amount of traffic to have on the roads. As you will probably be aware, I have a different view of the council subdivision code to some of the council officers, in that they take the traffic flows that are in there as being absolutes that shall be exceeded. My view is that there is scope within there to allow for variation. So for example, if you have a road that is subject to a traffic flow of 200 vehicles per hour, the subdivision code would suggest it's a certain type. The council's application is that when you have 201 vehicles, you need a different type of road. My view is that the first type of road is actually carried 201 vehicles. The analysis that I've got within here is all based upon the council's interpretation of the subdivision code. So I've said that this 200 hypothetically is a rigid threshold for how much traffic can accommodate. The reality is it can accommodate more, firstly because the roads are wider than the subdivision code would suggest should now be built in the district. And secondly, because of that, what I believe is an inherent flexibility to exceed those thresholds. So, if you wish, I can do the analysis to show what the numbers would show. I accept it isn't there at the moment. But my feeling, my belief is that it not significantly changed my conclusions, because although the traffic would increase, there will be mitigation measures that could be taken into account as well. I've danced around the issue of amenity. It is a difficult one for a traffic engineer to quantify. We don't say it's the ability to cross the road or things like that.
It doesn't work for engineers, it's not a 1+1.
There are only a few of these active sport recreation zones in this area of the district, we've been told where they are. Is it usual, or are those other active sport recreation zones down what appear, at least on the surface, to be quiet residential streets? The two sports grounds in Queenstown, the sports grounds in Arrowtown, and the Millbrook Cricket Club.
Okay, so the...
And even if you included the one at the event centre, which are sports zones, but because it's wrapped up into another zone, it doesn't happen to a spin zone. Community purpose.
I think the second ground is in Queenstown, obviously the back is one of them.
Warren Park, the answer is no. Red Ground, the answer is no. Campdown, Event Centre, the answer is no. Cricket, Millbrook Cricket Club, the answer is no.
There's a rugby ground, I think, like the King of Arrowtown. That is a yes.
Yeah, there's a yes for the Arrowtown sports ground.
Is it, in traffic engineering terms, is that ideal?
In terms of the hierarchy of the roads, the question is the extent to which you get through traffic. And so if you have what is essentially a local road with higher proportions of through traffic within it, probably not. In this case, I've understood from Dr. Galloway's original evidence, the majority of the users are going to be pulled from the local area anyway, so it's Brightsdale, Lake Hayes, and Shotover Country. So they are sort of local trips on the local network, and that's fine. In Christchurch, I've just done a proposal to increase the Cambridge Centre up in the northeast of the city. That is served by, for example, a local road. So I think I don't think it's a blanket approach, I think horses for courses, as it were. And if this is intended to be a sub-regional or a regional facility, that's a different scenario to if this is a situation that is provided for the local community with a bias towards those three existing subdivisions.
Well, I think Mr. Galloway said that would be for that whole wider area, including the other side of Ladies Mile and
Development. Yeah, I think in due course, what we'd have is essentially this is a centre focus of population. I think what I was thinking about is if it's a facility that you would have, fully equestrians from all over Otago, or a sports academy or something like that, which would again be sort of working on more of a regional basis rather than something that's quite local. If this is just pulling from Queenstown, from Arrowtown, and the three subdivision plus what's on the, whatever you call it, on the northern side, I think being served on the local road is reasonable, provided the local road is able to accommodate travel.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, just expanding on that, what's been, again, your evidence was, and it's a question I posed originally, was your evidence is based on the locality being Lake Eyre Estate, Shire of Country, and the retirement village. But in effect, what you're actually looking at is the Tennis Academy, which is exactly the way it's called, which is will be a centre of excellence for a wider area.
Yeah.
And an equestrian centre, which again, well, I don't know if there's many people in Howard's Drive that have horses in the backyard. So there seems to me to be a conflict between some of the evidence that's been presented and your brief, which is basically looking at a more local route.
Yeah.
Would you accept that?
So I looked at the predominantly local area based upon Dr. Galloway's evidence that was provided to me, where that was the area that was drawn from. But I think there's also a difference between the two examples that you chose of the equestrian centre and the tennis centre. The tennis centre will have children attending who will be attending in the morning, who will then head off to school. So there will be traffic in the morning peak hour that's generated by that. For the equestrian centre, most equestrians are not sort of working on that sort of basis. They tend to be weekendly type of things, because you need to take the time to look after the horse and the like. So an equestrian centre of the same size with the same number of people attending won't have that same effect on the peak hour network. So there's more capacity outside of the peak hour to absorb additional traffic flows over and above what you would normally expect if you just looked at this peak time.
One of the comments again that occurred to me was the equestrian centre is going to have a different vehicle use.
Yeah.
When we had the A&P show in Monica, and we had horse floats parked that ended up getting Freedom Camping tickets. I had some vociferous feedback on, but then you're dealing with a different scale of vehicle.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a horse float with minimum a large vehicle, potentially even a furniture moving style vehicle. Is that appropriate through, coming down through Judge and Judy Drive?
If you were to say use Winter Place as an example, that's wider and the route is fairly direct. So I'd say that's entirely appropriate for those sorts of vehicles. Not which of the place itself, but the road that it links onto is actually a bus route anyway. So you do have regular large heavy vehicles that are moving around that particular part of the network, which would be larger than typical buses, about 12 metres or so. And then some of the rigid horse floats will be a little bit smaller than that, so they'll be comparable. The network is able to accommodate those types of vehicles. In terms of horse float being towed, it's horse floats are generally not any different size to a very large trailer. And they were tall as they appeared bigger, but in terms of length and wheelbase, if you look at both of them, they've actually got two axles. And if you look at some of the large trailers, they've got two as well. And they're able to be accommodated on the roof in Brighton.
And as an engineer, you'd be able to tell me that coming from Hayes Creek Road up to Judge and Jury Road, anything is achievable.
The road's built to the council standards. Yeah. Most people are not trying to tow a horse float in a Suzuki Swift. They've got something a bit more grunty. And so those vehicles are able to haul up there. They wouldn't potentially be able to haul if they had a heavy load and it was frosty or wet or something like that, but those are the times when you wouldn't be holding those sorts of vendors down there. The other thing from an equestrian point of view is that we are talking, we're assuming that people bring the horses there. There will be some people that do that, there'll be some that will presumably try to keep them on site.
Brevity of his original evidence is not prepared to summary or answer any questions.
Yes, having heard the evidence, I acknowledge that some rules that might relate to buildings would be appropriate. There is currently a discretionary activity status for buildings, and there are some assessment matters that relate to the assessment matters that are in the proposed zone vary depending upon the landscape category. And currently the land has been identified in the ONL. There is a set of assessment matters for ONL land and it's set for RCL as well. So that's to be resolved, obviously. Those assessment matters do talk about issues that would address some of the concerns that were raised by the panel earlier in relation to the numbers of buildings, the height, colours, location. So those are matters that are identified in the assessment matters, but I'd be happy to go back, as Mr. Goldsmith indicated, and review that a bit more closely.
Also address the issue. I mean, there's been an informative discussion about traffic. We will also look at traffic effects.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Did I hear you correctly that you thought there was already a control over a consent requirement for buildings in the active supporting inversion zone?
Yes. Sorry, I'm not texting on the rules.
No. Well, looking at the latest version from Ms. Angeli's evidence. I'm sure it hasn't changed.
It's a control over commercial recreation.
Yeah, commercial recreation, but not, I think ordinary new buildings associated with permitted activity is permitted.
Subject to the height and size standards.
Yeah. Yes. Recreation facilities are permitted in this.
Yes.
Provided they are commercial. Organised sport recreation and buildings associated with that is permitted. Clubrooms, I think you talk about all those activities are not permitted in the informal recreation zone.
Right. Yes, that's right. And the status of buildings, I mean, whether they are restricted discretion or discretion, I don't think would be of significant difference, really. But bringing some of those controls in would be...
But I'm just questioning whether they're restricted discretionary at all. I think my feeling is that a lot of buildings could be permitted, subject, of course, to the size and height requirements.
Yeah, all right.
So, if you can just bear that in mind and then look at the range of effects, because that was going to be my question for you, and we've really covered it all now, is that there's a reasonable difference between informal recreation and active sport, and potentially between rural and what either of the zones. In terms of the range of activities that are permitted, the scale of buildings associated with them that are permitted, and therefore the effects of all of those. I'm struggling with whether, as permitted activities, we've really got sufficient assurance that those effects would be controlled sufficiently. And if not, then
Mission chair.
Right, so I don't have any further questions for you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioners. We will come back to you on that. And just as an example of why it's probably appropriate to have degrees of control, at the moment, that tennis academy has had a very detailed traffic analysis done in terms of judging to drive. To the hours, the people, and so on. And obviously there could be a future combination of things that could have different levels of effects. And in addition, there was a discussion started with the council along the lines of, well, if the Tennis Academy goes ahead, should the access be via Widgeon Place or Judge and Jury Drive? Because Widgeon Place is actually better, you know, it's wider, better designed, and Judge and Jury Drive isn't to a degree. So,
although I think you'll find that Queenstown Park might have most of which place for parking for the Commonwealth Place.
For them.
That could be even presented in Spring 13.
Parking for the
gondola.
The gondola.
Well, between the gondola and between the gondola and the river jet, we may end up with a vast park and ride down here. That's the case. We will come back to you on the control issue, particularly buildings and traffic, anything else we can think of, and map or plan, and that will be done by the end of the week.
Yes, and thank you very much. Infrastructure.
Just the 27 metres that you alluded to for a reserves contribution, 27 square metres, was that per hectare or per lot?
Per house. Per lot.
27.5.
That's right. So whenever you do a subdivision plan, you're going to have X times 27.5 either on the ground when you pay a check.
Yeah.
And then there's a debate with the council as to can you use a reserve for stormwater as well? Or
comes from part 20 below the ground.
Yes, correct.
But it's always
the
one
final point to finish off with, which Mr. Evans reminded me of, is in terms of the floodplain, of course, the entire Queenstown rec ground is a floodplain. Now, the Queenstown Event Centre, that whole sunken in ground, is designed as a flood detection pond when it floods, so it happens.
So is Pembroke Park, given the right conditions, so is Pembroke Park.
last one, I think. Have a good Christmas.
Two submissions on stage two of the PDP relating to chapters 29, transport, open space and recreation, and the variation relating to visitor accommodation. And the relief sought has largely been resolved by the recommendations made in the 42A reports and rebuttal evidence, and there's only a few transport related matters remaining, the majority of which Mr. Carr, when he comes back, will be able to concentrate on, because they're quite technical transport matters. But the only thing I really wanted to raise in terms of my summary was in relation to the application of the high generating traffic activity rule 29.4.10. I consider that the addition of subclause A in Ms. Jones' rebuttal chapter results in an unworkable rule, I guess. The submitters sought the inclusion of the consideration of the traffic generation by existing activities as an addition to policy 29.2.1.3, which is now recommended to be deleted by Ms. Jones, or as a matter of discretion within the rule, which I think is more suitable and workable. I also have concerns with the rebuttal version of that rule and the movement of the matters of discretion A to E into the assessment matter section of the chapter. I consider that leaving the effects on the transport network as the only matter of discretion for the respective discretionary rule is akin to having a discretionary activity status for the activity, notwithstanding the recommended assessment matters, because section 29.8.1 in the chapter states that council is not limited by the assessment matters. So when I had a look at that, I also reviewed the chapter in its entirety. And there, I consider that there's a level of inconsistency in the drafting, which will make it a little bit, the chapter a bit difficult to interpret and administer, because some of the matters of discretions and the rules are located within policies. For example, policy 29.2.5 has additional matters of discretion for rule 29.5.1. Some of the matters of discretion and the rules are very broad and then rely on assessment matters, like the previous example I highlighted. And other rules only rely upon the listed matters of discretion, for example, rule 29.4.6. So I think to make the chapter easier to read and interpret, that there should be a consistent approach applied across the chapter, if possible. That's all I had to raise.
On your comment on 29.4.10a, this is the bit that's underlined that's been included, is that correct?
So, yes, and sub clause A.
Is it? Is the problem with it the draft rule or the actual intent?
No, I support the intention, but so it could be the drafting. I just think that as a rule, it you have to use is subjective, I guess, because it says are the same, similar, or less in character and testing scale, and that's not an easy thing for someone to come in and say. Yes, it's definitely similar. You'd need to include traffic engineering. There's still a little bit of subjectivity in the rule.
It's a term used in the Act, though, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. Yes, I just think that the rule should be drafted to be very clear as to whether it's triggered or not.
Have you tried drafting a clause that might deal with the intention without and create certainty?
No, I haven't drafted a replacement for subclause A. The original, in the submissions that I originally lodged, it was, I recommended it as a matter of discretion in the rule rather than a part of the rule trigger. But I could have a go at trying to write.
Well, that might be helpful for us if you did, and if you could get that in by the end of the week. Yes.
So I've raised concern about the wording of the subjective wording of this rule, and the evidence to us is that it's come from a mixture of the similar rules in the Auckland Unitary Plan and the Christchurch District Plan. They both have similar rules. But the Christchurch one in particular is worded differently. So if you're looking for inspiration, you may or may not be able to find it in notes, but at least be aware of what's in those rules.
Yeah.
You suggesting that we should look for inspiration to Auckland?
Well, not actually all Christchurch. but no, I'm leaving that to mislead.
Yeah, just following off that issue, and I noticed in your paragraph 18, talking here about the following, a set additional matters being taken into account by traffic generating activity. I read Mr. Carr's evidence as well, the same point, and I think Mr. Wells will be there, of course, later on another matter, makes similar comments. It's about that the activity is committed within the zone, so in other words, if the zone provides the activity, it shouldn't be constrained. But I'm wondering whether the development in the last 20 years of planning has evolved, but that's really the case anymore. For example, noise is a good example of a standard like that. I mean, it's a measurable standard, but people don't know whether they comply or not. The activity might be committed in the zone.
Well, you'll see from Ms Jones' rebuttal, and I think Mr Crosswell's rebuttal as well, they didn't accept that that was a valid matter on the basis that traffic modelling hasn't been done for all of the zonings that are going from PP. Like, if it has, it's been high level and based on assumptions, it may not, you know, prove to be correct or not. And I kind of I acknowledge that I guess constraint, and I felt like it would still be, it's kind of a bit damned if you do and damned if you don't. Because council's relying on traffic modelling to recommend refusal of some zonings, and then they're also relying on it to support other zonings. And so, in some respects, I feel like it should be a valid consideration, but then again, I do acknowledge that it's all high level. So it's one thing that I think that would be good is perhaps a matter of discretion, so that that could be taken into account, but it wouldn't necessarily be the trigger for the assessment of the rule.
Okay, so what you're saying is that and I do understand the underlying concern, I think we have underlying concern about this issue as well, is that you prefer to see it basically addressed as an assessment matter of discretion rather than as a trigger for permitted law.
Yes, that's right.
I understand that. Just, that's probably more of a question for Mr. Carr. It does come up in reference to paragraph 29, talking about thresholds for residential development in terms of number of vehicles that might generate hydro-generated vehicles. Is that proposed standard, does it take into account the situation that typically applies in this district as opposed to other areas? Is that a valid standard to have in place like in South Wanaka, say compared to Christchurch or other places where similar standards apply?
And meaning the numbers?
Yes, the threshold.
Threshold. I think Mr. Carr would be best to answer about the numbers, but my point was more that there's a disconnection between the threshold for visitor accommodation units and for residential units. And in this district, a lot of developments can go either way, and I agree with the council officers in saying that it's probably not going to be the ultimate determining factor whether someone does a visitor accommodation compared to residential, but I still think it's going to be taken into account.
I think in part the question is how many people here would be seeking to build 100 residential units as opposed to 50. Because the test is building them, it doesn't seem to be a subdivision test, it's not a creation of 50 lots. And that's what I'm finding interesting, because it's not a subdivision test, so it's not 50 lots, it's actually 50 residential units. I'm just wondering how many of the developers in this district actually build 50 residential units, as opposed to creating sites that 50 units could be built on.
True. Well, my type of property, one of those, and that they're proposing more than 50 units, more than 50 residential units. So it would definitely impact them, but that's one.
going on one of the areas of remaining disagreement between, Mr. Carter, between yourself and the councillors, otherwise rather discreet issue of aisle dimensions. Again, I've sort of come from a situation that we've applied in this district, the sort of vehicles we find in this district, some of which are very large, seem to be a high proportion of SUVs, people movers, camper vans and that kind of thing. Again, then does the relief you are seeking reflect the realities of this district as opposed to a standard that might apply somewhere else?
Yeah, again, Mr. Carter will be the expert on this, but I think if you look at all around New Zealand, car sizes have increased since the standard was adopted in 2004. You know, you go to Auckland and there's a large proportion of SUV type vehicles on the road. And, you know, a number of recently reviewed district plans all adopt that standard without questioning or changing any of the aisle width. So that's the basis of, you know, my question. Because car parking is always the thing that, you know, takes up a lot of land, it's always constraints no matter which side of the site it is, whether it's flat or whether it's sloping. And so that's an important factor to get right, and I don't think that there's necessarily enough proper evidence, like district specific evidence, to say Queenstown compared to the rest of New Zealand needs a greater aisle width.
Which brings me on to my next question, which also arose from people questioning officers, and it relates to accessory parking standards. Again, but probably obviously Mr. Carr to assume there will be a question on this matter, because some of the evidence we received on behalf of the council was sympathetic to providing more flexible arrangement with relating to policy 29225 in particular. Again, without getting on this issue of this district, in some parts of this district in particular, the industrial business areas, and we realise the industrial zone provisions still have come up, there seems to be clear evidence that there is a serious on-street parking problem that's apparent. It would be faced with evidence saying that the lift standards should become even more liberal than they already are in terms of not requiring minimum. Again, it's the same question, I guess, which is, are what we put before us tailored to the realities of this district?
I think, yeah, two separate comments. In terms of the industrial business zones, are totally correct. There is, you know, specifically when you drive or risk present in Wanaka, there is an on-street car parking problem. Resource consent for a client in at the moment, and they had to reject the car parking, and it resulted in a shortfall of one car bay, and I said it's not going to work, you're going to have to redesign it, because they need to comply with car parking at a minimum, in my view, down the sustainability drive. But in terms of other locations, for example, in terms of Ngaitaru Kopi, you know, the Gorge Road, the business mixed use zone, that's a little bit different in that a lot of potential people that would live there would be able to walk into their into town where their employment would be, you know, fresh choice where they'd get their groceries, to the bus if they had to go elsewhere. So I think that officers have done a good job in trying to balance, you know, there needs to be flexibility in terms of the car parking requirements for areas which have got good accessibility to public transport and moving to employment areas, but yeah, the other bits that are more car-centric probably need to be a little bit more conservative in that relief.
Yes, a couple of questions, please. Ms. Leith, can you just help me in terms of your interpretation of 29.410? in relation to subdivision activity. So this, it starts off this rule by saying any new land use or subdivision activity that exceeds the traffic generation standards or thresholds. And then when you turn to the table, it is, the chairman said, there's nothing there about lots. It's always, it's all about residential units. And I'm interested in your interpretation of why subdivision activity is included in the rule itself. When is it only to apply when there's a joint land use and subdivision activity going through, so that there are residential units being developed at the same time as the subdivision, like say for a unit title?
From reading the rule, and it's not something that I've noticed till now, I would have expected that it would apply to a subdivision of greater than 50
lots.
Yeah.
So whether they've got a house on them at that time or not, you would have anticipated that it applied to a greater than 50 lot subdivision.
That's right. And perhaps you've got these all other activities rules down the bottom.
Yes.
Could be
as wide as any activity, including subdivision activity.
Yes.
So it could be that the 50 isn't the relevant number, but it's the traffic generation and the bottom two rows.
Mm.
Right. Thank you.
If you wanted to remove ambiguity from that, what would you do instead?
Probably put development type.
Jones has said in response to the change in the threshold for the number of residential units is that residential units mostly require a consent of some form anyway. So it's not like this is the only reason consent's being made, but it's obviously a different reason and another matter to consider. And she's also said that it can bring benefits in terms of not having to provide the maximum or the minimum amount of parking. Do you see it that way, and that one of the benefits of making an application for greater, say for Ngātahu properties for a development that's got greater than 50 residential units, is that a rationalisation of the parking in a particular context could occur?
Yeah, that's right. So with the changes that Ms. Jones has recommended as part of the rebuttal, that addressed that potential issue that we had raised. I think there's a lot of benefits in it, because using the example again of the Gorge Road for systems use zone, a lot of people that might live in that zone will definitely benefit from improvements to the network, the active travel network and public transport network that was part of it.
Yes.
And they wouldn't necessarily need a high amount of cars.
No, and it wouldn't need to go through its own parking resource consent then. It would all be looked at as part of this one.
That's right, because buildings in that zone are restricted discretionary activity anyway, notwithstanding all the site standards.
So. Yes. So with the change now to say that you don't have to meet the parking requirements and the high traffic generation, and that high traffic generation allows the parking to be considered more broadly, that is a benefit to your client.
Definitely.
And then just on one other topic, just because you've raised it and Ms. Jones has responded, it's to do with this clause about off-site parking. And one of the things, again, is the rule that says that one of the situations that off-site parking can be provided is where there's public transport within 800 metres. And you've said, well, that doesn't really matter. It's the ability to walk to the off-site parking that's the issue. And that's another one of the standards. She said that, well, I think it's because, I'm assuming it's because people are less likely to use the off-site parking than on-site parking. That off-site parking is more suited to areas where travel is not so frequently by private motor vehicle. In other words, areas where there are alternatives such as public transport close by or walking. That's a criteria for enabling off-site parking. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I understand. So when you get to the end of your driveway and you've got the option of going 800 metres to your car or you've got 800 metres to the bus, I know it's to create that hesitation, like, oh, I might take the bus. But I think that people are quite often lazy, you know, if they have the option of the car and, you know, driving to a place where they know that there'll be a car park, they'll get in the car most of the time. Well, that's current behaviour, isn't it? So yeah, I still think that being within 800 metres of a public transport stop is more of a valid criteria for allowing a shortfall of on-site parking rather than off-site parking. I think if you're still providing the same amount of car parks but it's on the site two doors down, I don't see the tie really.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have a summary, happy to take questions. Try not to leave them and answer Commissioner Nixon's questions and direct it in this leaf, but I'm happy to ask them again. There's some stuff in here which I'm raring to get stuck in.
All right, well, just obviously, due to the line of questioning, I guess what raises the question is one size fits all approach between different authorities. I can fully understand why standards. But if you look at the 2001 Australian standard for aisle widths or parking space size, how has that been updated due to changes in the vehicle fleet in the last 20 years?
It hasn't been updated, but I think the important thing is quite large parts of that standard are actually included in the notified district plan. So what I have here is something that may assist. It's just a copy, and I'll ask you discretion on this chair. What I've done is I've just photocopied parts of the district plan and photocopied parts of the standard. And it may assist in answering Commissioner Nixon's questions if you were to have those in front of you. I can talk to them if you didn't want to receive it in paper version, but it just might be a little bit easier if you were to read the paper.
Can you?
Keep them close. Avoid those.
recall the district plan that you copied is about 15.9 and the appendix B 15.10.
So what you have before you, 15.9, I'm sure you're familiar with, 15.10 is a photocopy simply from the standard, and that's the standard. And there's no annotation, no changes that have been made to 15.10. You've heard evidence that the standard can't be applied because the vehicles are different in this district to what's in the standard. So if I could just direct your attention to the first pages on both. 15.9, the top image there, is of a plan view of a vehicle and got certain dimensions on it. If you turn the page of 15.10, you'll see exactly the same vehicle. And when I say exactly the same vehicle, literally a photocopy. It's not even been transcribed or made to look any different. It's literally a photocopy. So the 85th percentile vehicle that's in the notified district plan is exactly the same as the 85th percentile district vehicle of the standard. Going back to that first page of 15.10, again, that has a vehicle on the bottom of it, has certain dimensions. That corresponds to the 99.8th percentile vehicle. Again, it's a direct copy, it's not a transcription. A good example for labeling simply be that the font sizes are exactly the same, the font styles are exactly the same. So you've heard evidence that the district can't accommodate the standard because the vehicles are different, but the district plan itself says the vehicles are the same. So there's an immediate inconsistency. The second issue is then, I thought perhaps these are vehicles that for some reason are now not as manoeuvrable or different manoeuvring characteristics as the standard says. So again, if you go on to the second page of 15.9, and the third page of 15.10. You'll see the swept path that's in the district plan is exactly the same as in the standard. It's not quite. But if you look at this, it's slightly stretched, and I can tell you exactly why that's happened. It's someone who's decided last moment that the district plan should be in landscape format and they've stretched the image. It also means, unfortunately, that the district plan the scale's wrong, exactly. But the critical point I want to make is that, this is a photocopy, it's a scan, it's not any transcription, it's not any different. So what we have is a district plan which has got exactly the same vehicle sizes as the standard, and it has exactly the same maneuverability of those vehicles as the standard. And I don't want to make a point, but if you were to be so inclined tonight and you couldn't get to sleep, you could perhaps have a look at the later pages of both. You'll see that the four swept paths of the district plan are exactly the same as the four swept paths in the standard. Now, the standard was developed to identify the vehicle types, identify the vehicle maneuverability, and then it said, and for these vehicles, this is what you need for your parking layout. It doesn't work, it's entirely inconsistent with the council, in my view, to say we have exactly the same vehicle, exactly the same maneuverability, but we need different car parking sizes. It doesn't work. But let's say we took that as our working assumption, let's say that's our framework. And someone designs a site which has got the car parking sizes of the standard, not the district plan, requires a resource concept. The vehicles that you test that car park with are the ones in the district plan, which are the same as the ones in the standard. So you go through a process of getting a resource consent, testing, using the vehicles of the standard and the maneuverability of the standard. What you'll find is that the car parking space sizes are the ones that are in the standard. So that particular applicant has gone through a process of applying for a resource consent for no benefit in terms of environmental outcome. Council has used up officer time in processing it, again for no outworking of mitigation of effects. The mitigation of effects is latent on many of the no-fly versions of the plan by the use of the vehicles that are in the standard. And so that's why, in my view, the standard is the one that should be used. It's simply a logical outcome of what's in the district plan already. It's certainly true that if you set minimum standards, then you are locking in developers or people to provide those standards if they want to avoid the resource consent process. It's also true if you were to just do away with those, then in quotes the market will decide, unquote. And to be fair, sometimes that works, sometimes you don't sell residential units without any market at all. But equally, there are times that the market doesn't work, and that's when you end up with significant on-street parking, more than the capacity of the road to be able to accommodate. In part, that argument was the reason why the parking reduction factors were put in place in the Christchurch district plan, I know you're familiar with it, because it was an attempt to try to quantify what reductions would be reasonable in which circumstance. So we stuck with the minimum parking, but then said if you meet the following criteria, you can reduce it. And that was a solution, rather try to have the maximum parking provisions within there. Maximums are very difficult to quantify, unless you have a situation like, say, Auckland, Tauranga has got them as well, where you have a compact centre with good public transport. Because it's very difficult to collect any data as to what the modal shifts would be. If you were to look at a supermarket, say, you can calculate the minimum parking by just counting the cars. You can't calculate the maximum car parking by doing the same sort of process. So the process that is generally followed when you're looking to convert from a minimum to a maximum is you find what the minimum is, bump it up by about 25%, and that becomes the maximum. And then over time, you reduce it down to achieve the modal shift that you're seeking. So I would be cautious at this stage about looking to implement maximum parking standards, because I don't think the data's there in the district. And until the public transport network is a little bit more developed, I think there's a risk that it will simply not cause the modal shift that we would be looking for. It will simply displace parking to areas that you wouldn't necessarily want to see.
There's another example which came up as the 800 metre distance for people using buses as a factor to take into account. One was Queenstown, for example, maybe Triple A as well, go 800 metres horizontally.
Yeah.
Queenstown, they can be 300 metres vertically.
Yes.
Which may mean that kind of simplistic standard may be completely inappropriate for a place like this.
I think there's merit in saying that it's a matter of discretion, because even when you are close to a bus stop, the provision at the moment in the district, firstly, isn't the same as it would be in 5 years' time, and secondly, a bus stop on, say, Gorge Road might have 10 services a day, a bus stop at Frankton will have 20, and it would be appropriate, in my view, that that has to be reflected somehow in any sort of parking reduction that you might want to make, or the likelihood of having to walk 800 metres. If you going to walk 800 metres, you think you might miss the bus, you won't do it. Whereas if you're walking to a bus stop where there are lots of services going through it, you go, well, if I miss this one, the next one's only 10 minutes behind. noting, recognising that 800 metres is a little bit of an arbitrary number anyway. Whenever you see anything from traffic engineering, it's got a double zero on the end, be suspicious. But in essence, I think the principle of recognising the proximity of a site to a bus road is a sound one. Thank you. One further question.
She hasn't been asked.
You want to clarify something that was asked.
We should perhaps supplement something that Ms. Leith said with respect to Commissioner Nixon's discussion about permitted development and whether that should be included in the high traffic generator law. I was just, what I did is in preparation is actually had a look at evidence that we've received before, and for hearing stream of 13, you heard evidence from Ms. Wendy Banks as a traffic engineer. She rejected some rezoning requests on the basis of the model effect. You heard evidence.
She wasn't always taking account of the decisions.
Hearing stream 12, she opposed rezoning because no modelling had been undertaken to support it. And you heard evidence for hearing stream 14 from next colleague of mine, Dave Smith, and he opposed rezoning on the basis of the traffic model. So I think the issue is one of weight that you attach. If you were to, as you just alluded to, attach little weight to the modelling, then I think it's entirely reasonable to retain the omission of the permitted comment. But it would seem to me to be unfair if a site has been rejected on the basis of traffic modelling, or even accepted on the basis of traffic modelling, to then have a second bite of the cherry. It would lead you to a situation where, as part of this review, a site has been rezoned and modelled as 500 houses. And the first thing that the person has to do is get a resource consent for 50. That doesn't seem to be a sensible outcome. So I think if you were to be minded, that the modelling is very high level, I would suggest that perhaps informs your thinking on some of the rezoning the officer's reports in that regard. And if the modelling that's been carried out at the Office of Recommendations in that regard are sound, then I think that principle should also be carried through to the wording of the high traffic generator law as well.
Yeah, that certainly clarifies it. Better for me than what it looked like initially and then reading the evidence. Because it does rely on the modelling, the initial modelling, sort of, I guess, the worst case scenario.
The QuizSAM model has been updated with all of the expected expected land use activities, certainly what the council is promoting. So that's formed the baseline for all the testing of additional sites and the submissions that come through. But yeah, if that's robust, it's robust. If it's not, it's not. But it's a matter of consistency in the evidence weighting, I suppose.
I suppose also the other thing flows from that, and I'll look at Mr. Wells' evidence, you probably haven't read his evidence, but it's coming after us, after your client, but raises the whole question of financial contributions and if land is to be rezoned. But the consent authority might say yes, it could be rezoned, but around about a kilometre up the road will need to be upgraded. We won't rezone until it's upgraded, which is a little bit, I guess, it's a bit like a gun to a developer's head, potentially, because unless he's prepared to put some money up to do the necessary upgrading, he won't be rezoning.
But that's pretty common, especially if NZTA are involved. Especially with NZTAs involved.
Funny that.
It's the same with the Preston subdivision in Christchurch that had thresholds that said until this intersection is upgraded, everything beyond it is non-compliant. That was an attempt to ensure that my clients, both for Preston and for this, put their hand in the pocket to upgrade intersections on the basis of the effect that they were creating. Shot over country, he here had the same issue that a certain amount of development was permitted to be served by the then existing priority intersection at Stalker Road. And then after that, a $2 million, $3 million roundabout had to be put in place. So there are quite a lot of examples of that sort of approach. And it's sort of, I guess, hinted at in Mr. Smith's evidence for Hume Street 14 that he said that certain sites should not go ahead because of a constraint on the network. The answer to that in the resource management sense is Mr. Smith said, well, what happens if we remove the constraint? But at least that then gives the developer the choice of whether to do that or not. If it is too expensive, they walk away. If they feel that it's an appropriate use of the finances, then they will fund the improvement scheme. But generally, the other thing is that these improvement schemes actually improve things for the wider community as well. So the Shotover Country roundabout, for example, was partly triggered by Shotover Country, but it was mainly triggered by the Shotover Road, because you actually couldn't turn right out of there in the morning peak hours. But when the roundabout has now gone in, it actually assists everybody coming from Arrowtown, the residences in that direction, to be able to get onto the highway and into Winston. So I can certainly see a case that says that a financial contribution from a developer is a good idea because of the wider community.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carr.
Thank you.
Now, Ms. Martin, do we have any advice on what's happening this afternoon?
So that will be the last submitted for today.
Sorry?
That will be the last submitted for today.
Right.
Yeah.